I know just about everyone here has seen Roots. And I trust everyone in here has read the autobiography of Malcolm X. One more little slip back into my teaching days of 25 years when I taught the last decade of teaching. I would assign the autobiography of Malcolm X to almost every course, no matter what the course was. And that book serves so well, so very well. All those of you in the audience who are in teaching, you just get that book and put it on the reading list. And I'm telling you, no matter what the discipline, you're going to find something in that book that will be relevant to your discipline. Yes. Alex Haley is here tonight. I must say that it is particularly special and significant to have Alex Haley with us at this marvelous, enthralling, wonderful event. Alex Haley.
Well, needless to say, thank you. I was sitting down in front earlier with Sister Betty Shabazz, and we were just kind of exchanging little bits to each other, and I said at one point to her, you know, Malcolm sees us all here tonight, and she said, I know it. And then I was thinking about that when other people have sort of expressed the same feeling. Brother C. Eric said something very similar. And back behind the curtains, before we came out here, Brother Clark said as much, and so did Amara Bakri. In his, all of us in our ways seem to have that sense of Malcolm's presence. And I was tickled when Eric Lincoln said that he could see Malcolm sitting over there impatiently waiting for him to finish talking. Because all of us who were close to him know that one of the biggest things about Malcolm was his intense sense of time. He was always watching his watch. And as a matter of fact, he had a saying that whenever he met anybody, one of the first things he would notice was, did they wear a watch? And if they didn't wear a watch, he didn't have any time. He didn't say boo to them because he didn't want to waste his time with them. That was his feeling about it. I guess most of us do some sort of little biographical thing. For myself, the first time I met Malcolm, I had been in the military service. I had been in the U.S. Coast Guard for 20 years, and I had just retired. And it was during that time that I had kind of, over the years, taught myself to write up to the point that I had now begun to sell to the Reader's Digest, which was a tough magazine to sell to. And I was extremely surprised when, after I got out of the service, the very first assignment, I went up and told them that there was this new kind of phenomenon called the Nation of Islam, or colloquially the Black Muslims. And I just kind of said it to them because I wanted to establish that I would like to write that if they later down the line decide they would like to do something about such an organization. And they surprised me very much by saying right then that yes, they would like to have it, and that they would like me to do a piece which told what people said against the organization as well as what the organization's members said of it. And then I found, with some little questioning, somebody, I guess just looking in the newspapers, that the spokesman was this man called Malcolm X. I wasn't quite certain how to get in touch with him, but I went to the Nation of Islam restaurant in Harlem, I think 116th, wasn't it right? 116th, huh? Yeah, okay, well that was it. And And I went in, and I must say I was really rather timid, having heard the reputation of this man. And I was standing there, and I remember somebody went by me with a piece of roast chicken. I never forget that, because it looked so good, and it had all that, you know. But I had to keep a mind on why I was there. And there was this man whom I just peripherally happened to notice in a phone booth. And what I noticed was he sort of gave you the impression of Ichabod Crane in a phone booth. His knees were up high. He was too tall to be in the booth, in fact. And he was just kind of looking at me, and I later learned that was the Malcolm X whom I'd come to see. And he came out, and in his very frank, direct way, he said, you are a spy sent by the white man. So I assured him that I wasn't, that as a matter of fact, I had a letter from the white man to prove I wasn't, you know. So Malcolm told me that he would not undertake such a responsibility, that I would have to talk with his leader, Mr. Elijah Muhammad, who was in Chicago. And he right there got on the phone and called Mr. Muhammad and came back and told me that Mr. Muhammad would see me. And I got expense money from the magazine, and at that time I couldn't buy a ticket to Chicago without somebody buying it. And so I flew to Chicago, and I think it was a Saturday, because the next afternoon, there in Mr. Muhammad's home, they were having a very formal dinner. And Mr. Muhammad invited me to come to dinner, and I knew very well I was being kind of appraised to see whether or not he would approve this article to be written by me. And everything was going fine. The food there was wonderful too. And it was being served, the table was being served by three young sisters who wore kind of veils and things. And one of them in particular was just something else. And as she went around serving whatever she had, I was kind of just following her without thinking about it, looking at her. And it wasn't long before I found that she moved behind Mr. Muhammad. I was looking right in his eyes, and he knew exactly what I'd been doing, was watching her around, and he was not smiling. But afterwards he told me that he would give me an opportunity to write an article about them if I would agree to do what the magazine had said, is tell their story as well as what people said against them. And then I went back. He had called Malcolm, and Malcolm talked to me. And Malcolm introduced me to other members of the Nation of Islam, and I got together pretty quickly a story that was titled Mr. Muhammad Speaks, that appeared in the Reader's Digest in the early 1960s. And subsequently, I got a nice letter from Mr. Muhammad saying that I had done what I agreed to do, and the magazine had as well. And Malcolm telephoned me. And it was during this period that Dr. Lincoln was, we were buddies. I don't remember exactly how we even met, to tell you the truth, but he was at Boston University. And Malcolm worked sort of with both of us, plus Lou Lomax, whom he mentioned. And Malcolm had a kind of a, it was sort of a thing like maintaining a little family of people in different things. There were a few of us who were journalists, and he kind of played us one against the other in a nice way. He liked to do things like you might have two people interviewing him. I know specifically one time, Lou Lomax and I both were interviewing Malcolm separately for different articles. And Malcolm had told both of us to go take rooms in the Americana Hotel. Is it still named Americana? Well, whatever it was. It's a Sheraton now. Well, then it was Americana. So there Lou was in one room, and I was in the other, in another room in the Americana. Neither of us knew the other was there, and Malcolm was letting each of us interview him separately. He just kind of liked those kind of little intrigues. And he used to have a saying about Lomax in particular. As Brother Lincoln says, Lomax Lou Lomax was kind of brash. He would, that's putting it charitably, Lou Lomax would do anything. And Malcolm used to have a saying. He said, when I see Lomax go by me, I follow him because I know he's either on to something or into something. And Malcolm liked to follow him. I make some cards just to give myself some sense of chronology. One of the things that, looking back upon it, that I really just am amazed at about the discipline, the self-discipline of Malcolm, was that I never knew until very late in my company with Malcolm, I had no idea that he was having problems within the Nation of Islam. He never, by word or hint or act or anything, let me have any idea of that for at least a year and a half. And the fact was, I would later learn that he was in difficulty with the organization from the very time I met him. But he just never talked about it. For about the first 2 months after the agreement had been made that I would do a book about him, and how that happened was, I did an interview of Malcolm. I had begun writing for an exciting new magazine that had come along, and I first was writing for the Reader's Digest. Then this other magazine came along, and a lot of magazine writers were really trying to get into it because it paid well, it was exciting to readers and everything. And so they hired me to do interviews of highly controversial people. And I found myself in a position of writing for two magazines, neither of which wanted you even to mention the name of the other in their offices. And that was the Reader's Digest and Playboy. And Playboy had me doing interviews of people like the American Nazi George Lincoln Rockwell, of Cassius Clay, as was mentioned when he was Cassius Clay. And as a matter of fact, I was interviewing him at the time you mentioned when he went down and fought. It was Liston, was it not? It was Liston. And I remember Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay telling me later, he said, do you remember after the second round that I hollered something at him? And I said, yeah, well, you could see that he hollered something at him. And he said, well, what I hollered was, I got you now, you big sucker. And the reason he said that was because he had in training let the word get out to Liston's camp that he was scared to death, and that was what had gotten Liston into training to do two rounds only. And so when the second round was over, then Muhammad Ali knew he had him. That was who he said. And Malcolm took the greatest of pride. There were two people, in my experience with Malcolm, whom he regarded pretty much as little brothers, and they were proud to be his little brothers. And one of them was at the time Cassius Clay, and the other was Louis Farrakhan. And if you listen to Farrakhan today and close your eyes, you sort of hear the cadence of Malcolm as if he practiced to sound like Malcolm when he talked. They were both very proud of that little brother status. But for myself, when I got with Malcolm to do the book, which resulted from a publisher reading the Playboy interview and asking Malcolm if he would tell his life in book length, because nobody knew anything about Malcolm. All he ever said, he would hardly ever repeat three sentences without saying, I was taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, or something to that effect. And he'd never said a word about himself. And so this publisher was Ken McCormick at Doubleday, asked Malcolm, would he tell his life in book length? And Malcolm demurred about it. He finally agreed. And then Malcolm asked me if I would be the one to write the book, as he'd come to know me somewhat during the Reader's Digest and Playboy interviews. And I was pleased, honored, flattered to have this opportunity. And so I began to work with him. At the time, I lived in Greenwich Village, 92 Grove Street, right off Sheridan Square. And I had a place, a basement. And it was, fortunately, kind of a long, oblong room. And Malcolm would come down there about twice a week. He would generally get there around 9:30, and he would stay until 11:30, midnight or so. When he arrived, his first thing, always, there was not even a talk about it, he'd go straight to the phone and call Sister Betty, and they would talk. she would give him messages and whatnot, and he would tell her that he planned to be home before midnight. And she knew good and well he wasn't going to get home before midnight, but he would always tell her that. And finally, he and I got into supposedly into him. I would say that 2 months passed, and I would ask him questions as artfully as I knew how. I had a typewriter at the time. It was what they used to call a silent typewriter. It didn't make as much noise as most. And I sat kind of in a corner, and I can type very rapidly and touch type, so I was just sort of taking Cabe Lease notes, you know, where you write it much the same as if you were sending a telegram. If somebody says a 10-word sentence, you don't really need to write more than 4 or at most 5 words to know pretty much what they said. And a couple of months went by, and I hadn't been able to get Malcolm to say boo about himself. Everything would come up. He would go right back again to the greater glories of the Nation of Islam, Mr. Muhammad. And I would say, when I got the nerve, Mr. Malcolm, I know they're both marvelous, but we really have to get something about you, because that's what this book is about. And finally, it came to me that I had to either go to the publisher and tell them that I couldn't get through to him, that they should either get another writer or drop their project, whatever they wanted to do. And then one night, it was in January, snow was knee-deep. Malcolm came down to my place down there, and he strode that room. He was like, not just this night, every night, he was like a caged tiger when he'd come in there. He just walked. He made an oval, I guess 100 times in the course of a night. He didn't want to sit down. He had big feet. He would just sort of, well, he did. He had big feet. And he would, and the way, what? Where are you? What size were his shoes, Ben? 14. They were size 14. That's what they were. But, and he liked to walk. And this particular night, again, I said to him, for maybe the 15th time, not that night, but over all the times I had said to him, maybe 15 times, Mr. Malcolm, we just have to get something about you. And this time, it just made him angry. He had a little houndstooth top coat, and he snatched it up, and I remember thinking, just sort of flashed through my head, that coat's too light for this weather. And he grabbed it up on his arm, and he went striding toward the door, and he reached for the handle and snatched it. And I don't know why on earth I said to him, it surely was not something I thought. It surely was not something you would say to an angry Malcolm. Just as he got the doors cracked open, snatching it open to go out, I saw the snow banked up over the door jamb. And I just said to him rather quietly, I said, Mr. Malcolm, could you tell me something about your mother? And I remember he just stopped as if he were a marionette on a string. And rather slowly, he closed the door, he turned, and he began to walk again. And he probably made 3 circuits of the room before he spoke. And when he did, his voice was up a little, like another register. And he was speaking rather as if it was stream of consciousness. And he said something like, it's funny you should ask me that. I can remember the dresses she wore were old and faded and gray. And then he walked some more. And he said, I remember she was always bent over the stove trying to stretch whatever little we had. And you know what? That man, that night, walked that floor on up until probably 3:30 or 4 in the morning. I never asked him a thing. He just spilled out of it what essentially is now to be found in the first chapter of the autobiography of Malcolm X, which is appropriately titled Nightmare. The little boy, about 7 years old at the time, was he 6? Yeah, I have to be careful about my facts here tonight, but with a number of children, little young children, The father recently had been murdered. He was a minister, and he'd been thrown under a streetcar. And there was the mother trying to keep this family together, and the state authorities were trying to take the children away. And she was just undergoing all kinds of mental stress. And Malcolm spilled out of him that night, walking that floor, his memories of it. It was about 2 weeks later, he said to me he had to make a trip. Well, you don't question that. Malcolm travels so much. And he went away, and he came back about a week yet later and said with a big, big smile, "I bet you don't know where I've been." And I didn't know where he'd been. And he told me that he had been to, I think, Michigan. And he and one of his brothers had gone to the institution where their mother had been for a long time, and they had taken the first steps to have her removed. And that was the beginning of a new phase. He said that he had kept all that bottled up in him just because he just didn't want to think about it. And he, from that night forward, never hesitated to talk about anything at all of his life that I would ask him about. And quite often he would volunteer things that I would not have known to ask him about. He had, like we all have, little eccentricities, I guess you could call them. One of them was that every now and then, Malcolm would go over to the Museum of Natural History here in New York City, and he would go look at the aardvark. The reason he did that was because, to jump way ahead in the years when he had been in prison, he had gotten a dictionary, and he had gotten long, legal-length yellow pads, and he had decided that he was going to get himself back into the world of English and grammar and things like that, that he kind of lost in the street, he felt. And he sat down, and again, it's pure Malcolm X, and he sat down with pencils. I think he said that he ordered one gross of yellow pencils. He even told me the number, which I forget. I mean, you know, the number of the graphite or the lead. And he said that he started from the very first thing in Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, and he wrote all day as long as he had time, and he kept on until he had finished the Z's. And he said the funny thing was, he hadn't really thought about that before, but when he got into the C's, he began every now and then to meet something he'd done in the A's or B's, and he began to realize that the dictionary was really kind of like a modified encyclopedia. And it was teaching him history and English, and it was teaching him civics and all sorts of things just in the dictionary. But in any event, the thing that always held a fascination for him was the aardvark, the double A animal, that he found as the very first word in the dictionary, and he always liked to go and look at that aardvark in the Museum of Natural History. Another thing that is not normally talked about in connection with Malcolm, and I know Sister Betty was aware of it, she probably would be about the only one here who I think, he had an absolute fascination for Shakespeare. He would come down to the house or the apartment. And I have a buddy, a researcher named George Sims, and George has read more books than any one soul I know in this world. And it came to be that an ideal way to set up an interview evening was that when Malcolm arrived, that he and George would get to talking about Shakespeare. And they would do that for maybe 30, 40 minutes until I would just have to say to them, you know, look, we're going to have to break that up and talk about Malcolm for a while. And that was the pattern of most evenings. There was a thing about Malcolm that used to fascinate me, among many things it did, was he had a saying. It was, quote, "I am a part of all I have met." And what it meant was, just really what it said, was that everything he had ever done in his life had left some residue, and that whatever he was at present was that collective residue of things he had gained or learned or touched in previous experiences. If you go back over his life just quickly, you see such a dramatic, heart-tugging, poignant, drama. A little boy who was in school in a place called Mason, Michigan. I know he was the only black in his class, and I think there may have been a couple of others in the school. He was an A student. He was extremely popular. He played basketball, and as a matter of fact, when came time for the eighth grade, he was voted eighth grade class president. Then it was at the end of the eighth grade when the class counselor would hear all the eighth graders about to graduate now into the ninth, and they would tell the counselor what they had ambitions to be, and the counselor would give them advice. And when he got to Malcolm, a student, Malcolm said he really didn't have any specific thing he all wanted to be all that much, but he didn't want to sound stupid and say nothing, so he had just read something a previous day about lawyers, so he just said to the man he wanted to be a lawyer. This man was an English teacher in whose class Malcolm got straight A's. And the man said to Malcolm, in sincerity, that that was a rather ridiculous thing for somebody of his color to want to be, of his race to want to be. And then he said to Malcolm, a student, I've noticed down in workshop, trade shop, the nice things you've made of wood with your hands. So why don't you plan to become a carpenter? You see how popular you are here in school, and what that means is white people would give you lots of work. And then he dismissed Malcolm. And Malcolm said he didn't react so badly to what the man had said to him, because in the world of Mason, Michigan, in the world he'd been used to, he knew that something more or less of that pattern happened, you know, to people his color anyway. But he said what began to get to him was when, in subsequent days, around school, in the hallways, he would hear other students in the class whom he knew were his scholastic inferiors talking, just chatting about what the man had told them to do when they told him whatever he wanted, they wanted to be. If it was a nurse, if it was a veterinarian, there was somebody who wanted to be a veterinarian, he remembered very much. And everybody that he heard was saying what the man had advised them to do, to be whatever they had said. And he said it was for that reason that he began to feel just funny, and he began to withdraw from people. And then Malcolm said, and this is, mind you, an eighth grade student, I guess at that age probably 14 or something like that, and he said that first it was fellow students who began to come up to him and say, what's the matter? You acting funny. You just don't act right. And he withdrew more, and then the teachers began to come because he was such an outstanding student. And they were all quite concerned. He just wasn't acting right. And that was the summer that he made his way to Boston, to the suburban Boston, or the inner city Boston community of Roxborough, and stayed with his cousin? Huh? All right, well, I don't know why I'm telling you this story. But yeah. But anyway, it was there that the straight A student met the streets. He met a young man who was from Mason, Michigan, who was called Shorty. And Shorty called Malcolm homeboy. And Shorty began to teach Malcolm street things. At first, very mild things, like he taught him how to shine shoes. And taught him that if you go ahead and shine shoes in the regular manner, people would give you a dime or 15 cents. But if you learn to let the rag be loose and snap loudly, make a noise when you buff the shoes, that people would give you a quarter. And so Malcolm learned that, and then he learned sundry other things of the street until he was a pretty good hustler. And then he got a job on a train and went to New York, which was the Mecca of all time. And there he, as he used to phrase it, he got his PhD in hustling and whatever in New York. And finally, after a period of time, he wound up, before he was 21, he heard someone tell him 10 years, and that was when he went into prison. And I don't know that there's anything I ever encountered in the year of interviewing Malcolm to write the book that gave me a better insight into the cleverness, the innate, sharp, incisive mind of this man than when he said he hadn't been too long in this prison. And that for some reason, the warden of the prison just hated him. And Malcolm said that the people who run prison are not the administrators, the prisoners run the prison. And he said that he knew that this man was so hateful toward him that the man was just waiting for a way to set him up so he could kill him. And he said the warden could actually do that. And Malcolm said he knew he had to think up something that he could do as a prisoner which would get this man off his case. And he said he thought and thought and thought about it. So finally, one day he got it together. And he said the warden would come down the hallway, and he wore a big ring of keys, so much so that people, you could hear the keys jangling before you could see the warden. And Malcolm said they'd had lunch served in those tin trays that have little receptacles in them. And he waited, listening to the keys coming toward his cell. And then at just the right moment, he got the tray sideways with the cutlery in it, and he shoved it out through the bars. And the tray, just as he had hoped, landed smack on the floor right in front of the warden, and food splashed up on him and everything, and the warden was ready to kill. The warden was beet red, Malcolm said. He burst up to the door, took one of his keys, opened the door, and came in there where Malcolm was, and grabbed Malcolm right in the collar. And Malcolm said it's exactly what he wanted, and so he now, that close, he shoved his mouth up even closer to the warden's ear and hissed in his ear, "If you lay a hand on me, I'm going to start a rumor that you're black passing for white." And he said he watched that man back away from him as gray as a ghost. And Malcolm said he never saw the man again. He never had no more trouble with him. There was another story I just jotted down here because Malcolm loved to tell it, and I always felt it was one of the insights into the softness, the tenderness of Malcolm. And that was something that people don't know a whole lot about. Sister Betty and I have at one another time talked about, and also Attila, their eldest daughter, whom I have come to know better than I do the other daughters, have talked about the tenderness of Malcolm, which is not normally something associated with him. People don't just think about that very much. But when Malcolm was in Harlem, he got a job working as a waiter at Small's Paradise. And he would describe for me how in the late afternoon, around 6:30 or so, it was a sort of a tradition that the street folk, this being the numbers runners, that level of street folk, people involved in, I suppose, some variation of drugs or this or that or alcohol or whatever, would gather in certain bars. One of the most outstanding Harlem bars was Small's, where Malcolm worked. And it was kind of a thing, this was where the dudes, I guess you'd call them, would come and they'd double park their Cadillacs, and the girls, the women they were with were sharp as could be. And it was just kind of like a salon. They would gather at around 6:30, and then they'd have drinks and they'd go on about their business. And then tourists would take over the place for the night. And Malcolm said that around 6:30, when these people, the hipsters, the sportsmen they used to call them, dressed immaculately, would be around the bar And the bartender was serving them with all kinds of honors to them, depending, you know, the big gambler would get, they wouldn't just give him a drink, they'd sit the bottle of what he liked in front of him. And Malcolm said that around 6:30 every evening, when these people were gathered having their ceremonial drinks, a man would come in the front door who was kind of bent over. He was kind of elderly. He was dressed not shabbily, but not well either. And you could see things like where his shirt was frayed, but it was clean. And Malcolm said when this man would come in, he would just kind of glance at the people on the back end where they were enjoying themselves. And they would see him, but nobody would make any outward, you know, expression one way or the other. And Malcolm said that he would stand outside the dining room with a big towel on his arm and watch this group back there as this man came in, and always somebody in that group would just kind of quietly gesture to Malcolm. The gesture meant that they would take care of the bill. And this man, this older man, would go on in the dining room, and Malcolm said he would sweep the chair back and with a great flourish put the napkin, the white napkin, all over his lap. And the man would sit very politely, and Malcolm would give him the big menu, and the man would order. And Malcolm would go in the kitchen and tell him who it was, and they called the man Mr. Fewclothes. And the kitchen would come up with the best, and Malcolm would serve it with a flourish. And when it was finished, the man would get up and he would go out, and he would just kind of nod at the group in the bar as he went out, and they would just kind of nod at him. Nobody said a word to him. The truth, that, not the truth of it, but the situation, the scenario, which it was that it was really a case, Malcolm said, of there but for the grace of God go I, for all these people at the end of the bar who were hustlers of one another nature. Because, he said, that man who came in had been for years the top pickpocket in Harlem. And what had happened to him was that he had gotten arthritis in his hands. And there's nothing in the world worse for a pickpocket than to get arthritis in his hands. And what had come up from these people was that he represented them, that some of them might develop something where they would need some help. And so it had come to be that they regarded Mr. Fewclothes, which was his nickname, as kind of their ward, and everybody looked out for him, and everybody loved him, and nobody said much to him because they didn't want to embarrass him. And Malcolm used to always say it was, he thought, one of the loveliest things that he ever witnessed among his people in Harlem. The things that characterized Malcolm would be heavily his sense of, I guess, self-security. When he first met me, I wrote in the book, he told me, I trust you 10%. And then talking, he finally said that the person he trusted more than anybody was over there, Sister Betty. He said, I trust her 90%. And he said that he trusted her more than he trusted himself, because he said, I might do something that I shouldn't do. And one of the things that I always enjoyed was, maybe 6 months later, one morning, maybe 2 in the morning, Malcolm called me from Los Angeles, and all he said was, when I picked up the phone sleepily and said hello, he said, I trust you 50%. So I had come somewhere by that time, I could tell. And I would say another thing, I just had a card here, is that I think I could safely say that in his subdued way about this particular subject of things, in his disciplined way, I don't believe I ever knew a man who loved a woman more than Malcolm loved Betty Shabazz. He is the truth. He didn't go off and run off at the mouth a lot about it, but in all kinds of little ways, little just side comments, little things about how he would be talking about something else entirely and just suddenly stop and talk about how much he thought of, how much he revered the lady who was taking care of the house, was taking care of the children, was keeping the messages on the phone as if she was a secretary who did everything. And he felt Malcolm carried around, I guess the biggest negative he carried around that I know about was his sense of guilt that he was not home enough. And somehow the guilt was even further exacerbated when she would tell him that she understood and that she never ever, he would say this repetitively, never ever had given him any grief about the fact that he was home so little and that he could never do for her what she deserved. That was the truth. And Sister Betty was telling in an earlier thing this afternoon that Malcolm did travel so much, and somehow it had just come to be, not by design, but I don't remember how I happened to call over their house one time when he was gone, and she and I got on the phone. And Sister Betty had to have been lonely because the man was gone all the time, the children would sleep late, and I'd call. And we just got into a thing of almost nightly phone calls. And nobody would have believed it, but what we did talk about mostly was we swapped recipes. I used to be a cook in the Coast Guard, and I love to cook to this day, and she could cook. And so we would swap recipes and talk about this and that and the other. And I was very concerned because I didn't want Malcolm knowing that I'm talking to Sister Betty at 12:30 in the morning and he's gone somewhere. And later on, I found out that Sister Betty had told Malcolm we were talking, and he thought that was fine. And then he wrote me a letter later telling me it was, why didn't I call Sister Betty sometime and talk to her? So that straightened up everything pretty well. And we just would, it made for a nice kind of sense of supporting what he was doing as best I could by talking with her. I have one little note here that I would share with you too, is that we hear so much about Malcolm. One thing I find I don't hear too much about, and I wish more of it were attached to him. Malcolm had such a deep-seated sense of wanting his people to be better educated and to pursue education. I think maybe the most dramatic single thing I ever experienced with him was one time I was riding in Harlem with him in the car. It was an Oldsmobile, blue. What year was it, Betty? Well, I don't know. Anyway, it was a blue Oldsmobile, and Malcolm, as I say, had these big feet. And you're riding with him, and because he's Malcolm, you're just a little nervous, or you don't show it. And we were riding along in Harlem, and then all of a sudden, screech, my God, the man was standing up on the brakes. And I knew we had it. Well, by the time I got myself together, Malcolm was just boiled out of the seat, out of the door on the driver's side by him. And when I look, he is standing up over three young men who had been shooting craps against a wall. And he was just giving them the devil. I never heard him holler at people like that. He was saying something like, other people inside there studying about you, learning about your people, and the best you could do is be out here shooting craps at the door. And he was just railing at them. And the three young men, I'd say they were 19, 20, 21, in that range, got up and they were sheepishly, once they recognized him, they were just sort of, they went slinking away. And what was so dramatic about that to me was that these three young men would have cut somebody else's throat. These were Harlem street guys. But Malcolm had the power, the drama, the charisma, the image, that when they recognized that was him, they just went to disappear. And that always got at me. And the thing about it is, where they were was what had made Malcolm so mad, and why he stopped the way he did, was they were shooting craps outside County Cullen Library, where the Schomburg collection is. It has the greatest collection about African-American people in the world. And there are, I find, I'm looking at cards and realizing that the time is going on and on, and I guess the main thing for me to wrap on is that Malcolm was role model personified. Sister Betty said at some point earlier tonight, he wasn't just on 125th Street, as people like to sometimes think. Malcolm was comprehensive, really, about this world in the course of his life, as it turned out. And wherever he went, he was observed and dealt with in role model style. He truly was. Toward the very end of his life, as Brother Lincoln was talking, mine was just from a different perspective. I was just doing a different thing with him. Their home had been bombed. And he called me one afternoon, and for the first time, I didn't recognize his voice on the phone. He sounded like somebody with a very deep, heavy cold. And he was trying to make sort of a little joke of it. He said, you know, well, I've got my wife and I've got my children, and we've got to have somewhere to live. And he wanted me to call the publisher and see if it would be possible to get some kind of an advance with which he might make a down payment. He said, you know, people are not quick to want to let me have a loan from the bank these days, and he kind of laughed. And things were getting toward the lower end of his life at that point. And throughout the book, throughout the interviewing process, Malcolm periodically would say something to me like, brother, I'm not going to live to read this in print. And you know, you sort of say, like Eric said, you know, you just stop talking like that, but you don't know what to say. And then another thing that I always like to remember with him was that he wanted a boy worse than anybody you ever heard of. And they had four girls. And by now, Sister Betty is starting to look like she'd had a large watermelon in her stomach or something. He would, one time, I remember he came up and she was there, he just kind of affectionately patted her stomach and looked at me, and he had a grin from ear to ear. And he said, that's that boy. And then there came the day that I turned in the manuscript on a Thursday afternoon. And on Sunday morning, I got the word that he had been assassinated, as same as Eric got it in Boston, I think, and I got it in upstate New York. And then after that, that quote boy he had pointed about turned out to be twin girls that she delivered, made the six daughters. I would say about Malcolm, just in sum, and not because I wrote it, but I would recommend that you read the epilogue, the ending part of the book, because that was the part that I wrote in the week following his death. I was just more than immersed. I was obsessed with trying to find and pull together and put on paper everything that I could think of that was not already in the book that was would help give insight into this man. And it took about 8 days of writing as nearly as I could, night and day, to get it together, to make it the end of the book, so that the book really would represent one man from birth to death, as it does. And I was thinking, flying up here for this evening, every time a writer comes to the end of the manuscript for his book, you sort of stop at that point. Eric can tell you that, Brother Clark can tell you, anybody else who's written a book. And you start thinking, now, how should I end this book? What is this special thing? And I am so glad. Now, we talk about 25 years later, since that moment was for me, what should I say? And I'm so glad now, and I wrote it down on a card, the way that the autobiography of Malcolm X ends. Malcolm X looked at me hard. Quote, a writer is what I want, not an interpreter, he said. I tried to be a dispassionate chronicler, but he was the most electrical personality I have ever met, and I still can't quite conceive him dead. It still feels to me as if he has just gone into some next chapter to be written by scholars and historians. And that's how the autobiography of Malcolm X was ended. And it's so prophetic, because now he is yours. You scholars, you historians, thank you so much.